This is This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. The photographer who called himself Brassai is known for his black and white photos of Paris in the 1920s and 30s. One of his famous photographs is titled "Lesbian Couple at La Monocle, Paris, taken in 1932. It shows a young woman in an evening gown sitting at a round table with another woman dressed like a man in suit and tie and slicked back hair. Her name was Violette Morris, who became an infamous cross-dressing race car driver and Nazi collaborator. Our guest Francine Prose was going to write a book about Morris, but instead has used her story as a centerpiece for her new novel, and it's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. The book follows the life of Lou Villar and is told from many different perspectives, a biographer, a journalist, a photographer, among others. It captures the cultures of Paris and Berlin in the years leading up to World War II and the rise of fascism. Francine Prose joins us on Radio Times. It's been a couple of years, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So what struck you about this photograph?
Well, it's an incredibly disturbing and beautiful photograph. I mean, I'd known the photo for a long time because I'm a big fan of Brassai's work, but I had no idea who the people in the photo were. And there was a show of Brassai's work at the National Gallery in Washington in like 1999, 2000, and there was a little wall text, and all it said was that the woman in the tuxedo was named Violette Morris and that she'd worked for the Gestapo during the Nazi occupation of Paris. And I went, oh, that's sort of interesting, and went on the internet, and you know you can find out anything in about two seconds. And what I found out was that, in fact, she had been an athlete, an auto racer, professional auto racer, discus thrower, javelin thrower, Olympic hopeful. And then in 1935, the French government took away her license to compete as an athlete because she was a cross-dresser, and apparently, cross-dressing was in violation of the Napoleonic Code. So, you know, how that happened. So Hitler found out about this and invited her to be his guest at the Berlin Olympics, the 36 Olympics. She went to the Olympics as Hitler's guest, and by the time she came back to France, she was spying for the Germans. She was the person who told them where the Maginot Line ended, and then she did go to work for the Gestapo, and she was assassinated by the French Resistance in 1944.
And she was a torturer.
And she was
known,
a torturer.
One of the nicknames for her was the Gestapo's hyena. So why not write a biography of Violette Morris, and why write a novel instead?
Well, I was originally thinking I'd do a biography and that I would talk about Brassai and Violette Morris. And my then French editor said, well, you know, the French are so sensitive about their collaboration history, you're going to have to spend 2 years in the Bibliothèque Nationale doing research. And I thought, I don't really want to spend 2 years in the Bibliothèque. And plus, it was so much more fun. I mean, it's one to write it as a novel. You know, it's one thing to write about the Berlin Olympics. It's another to write about the Olympics from the perspective of a furious cross-dressing athlete who feels that her life has been a failure and suddenly is Hitler's darling. And to see it through her eyes was fabulously interesting.
It's not really fair to talk about a photograph on the radio, but I'm looking at a copy of it now. And what's so curious to me is that, yes, it's two women together, one dressed as a man. They're clearly looking at something, but there doesn't seem to be chemistry. It's sort of a tabula rasa. You can see so many different things in this photo. I mean, it feels almost staged.
Well, it was almost staged. I mean, it was staged because Brassai did, although we think of him as someone who, I mean, he did go into the nightclubs, go into the brothels, go onto the streets and take photographs. He would also stage some. So he had a nightclub set up in his studio. And in fact, there's a very famous photo of his that I talk about in the novel, and it's a dead body being picked up off the street, Rainy Street in Paris. He'd seen something like it, and then he proceeded to stage it outside his window.
And there's something about a black and white photograph, especially at that time, taken in the 1920s and 30s, is just so evocative.
Yeah, and he worked with glass plates. I mean, long exposures. And he said something like, well, he had two different kinds of cigarettes that he would smoke for the different exposures, like a long Gauloise for the long exposures and a short one for the short one. And he would carry, I don't know, 24 glass plates was as much as he could fit in his pockets. And when he took the 24, he would go back home.
And Paris at this time, I mean, this is the 20s and the 30s. Obviously, there's the, you know, impending Nazi Holocaust. But nonetheless, there was this sort of subculture that certainly these women were a part of, and Brassailles was very interested in.
Yeah, I mean, these clubs existed. There was this club, Le Monocle, was a cross-dressers club. And Brassailles took a number of photos there that are fantastically interesting. And oddly enough, I mean, I kind of lost track of the club when the novel ended. But recently I was reading a biography of Jane Bowles, and she went to the club in the 50s. So it still existed. And I was, you know, I read the page in her biography about 10 times. I said, really? It's still there? Mm.
Is there something interesting as a novelist and even what pronoun you use as a writer when talking about someone that's a cross-dresser?
Yeah. I mean, you have to be careful. Yeah. I mean, in this case, I use she all the way through, but yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your novel. And as I said, this is a story told from a number of different perspectives, and this is the perspective of the photographer in your story.
Yeah. And, well, the photographer, like Brassailles, is writing letters back home to his parents in Hungary. So, and like Brassailles, also asking for money, boasting about his accomplishments, talking about his life. Paris, May 14th, 1924. Dear parents, last night I visited a club in Montparnasse where the men dress as women and the women as men. Papa would have loved it, and Mama's face would have crinkled in that special smile she has for Papa's passion for everything French. The place is called the Chameleon Club. It's a few steps down from the street. You need a password to get in. The password is, police, open up. The customers find it amusing. A bar, a stage, a dance floor, leather banquettes, tables around the edges. A typical Paris nightclub, except for the clientele. But here's the most surprising thing. The owner is Hungarian. She calls herself Yvonne. She's tall and blonde and dresses in red and has a weakness for sailors. She sings in that husky voice Papa adores, subdued and choked with tears. When she sang, I heard Papa's phonograph muffled and locked in his study. Yvonne's song was about a woman whose sailor boyfriend has drowned at sea. I'd never heard a sadder song, not even from the gypsies. Yvonne sang with her eyes closed, one hand raking her hair. In her other hand, pressed to her forehead, she held an unlit cigarette. She sang, I will never see him again, never, never again. A mournful arpeggio rippled from the out-of-tune piano while the tenor saxophone looped circles around the voice. The other musicians put down their instruments and sat back, watching Yvonne. It's over, she sang, all over. I felt clammy and chilled to the bone, though the club was smoky and hot. I reached for my camera, the way, as a boy, I used to reach for your hands, but I'd left it in my room. I was hoping to make a few friends before I asked to take pictures of bankers and diplomats whose wives might not know that their husbands go out dancing in high heels and dresses. Even after a year in Paris, it took some getting used to. The hardest part was not staring, or was I supposed to stare? Photographing these birds of paradise will be a challenge, don't you think?
That's Francine Prose reading from the very beginning of her new novel. It's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. And I mean, I love the way you sort of capture what it's like inside a club like that. I feel the smokiness, the mystery of it, and the fact that the people can go there and be what they're not in public.
It was so much fun, you know, because I got to make up this club. I mean, I knew there was a real club, but that was all I knew, and a few Brassailles. So I got to make up the floor show, the dance routines, the musicians, the waiters, and I drew stuff from all over. I mean, for example, the song that Yvonne sings, there's this fabulous Bela Tarr movie, the Hungarian director, in which a woman sings this incredibly beautiful song. Mm-hmm. So I just played it over and over, the clip on YouTube, and that was sort of what I was taking. And then a friend sent me a clip of a bunch of contortionist sisters from the 1950s, and which was so wild and crazy, singing some song like Solid Cold Potatoes, or, you know, really, really weird. And so I made one of the main acts be a contortionist act.
But did you feel a need to go to a club like this?
I'm fascinated by drag queens and crossdressers. So there's one. There's a guy named Justin Vivian Bond who performs in New York. So I saw everything he did. You know, and back in the day, I used to see Charles Ludlam and the Ridiculous Theater and so forth. So I've always been interested in
What's the fascination for you?
Well, because it really makes you think about gender and what gender is. Is it the clothes you wear? Is it how you feel? Is it how you define yourself? Is it something so deep that none of those things apply? Why do you want to dress in the clothes of the opposite gender, et cetera, et cetera? So all those things, I think, go so deep.
Well, and I think it's, for whatever reason, it's human nature to sort of orient yourself to somebody else thinking that you know what gender they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a question, you know, we ask of a baby or even of a dog. Is it a boy or is it a girl? As a way of sort of figuring out, well, how am I supposed to be in relation to this other person?
Yeah. And the expectations that go along with it. I remember when I was pregnant with my kids, I was basically a cross-dresser because in those days, the only maternity clothes you could get were basically baby clothes. So I would get these huge men's suits and wear them because they fit. Right. And it felt kind of great being an extremely extremely pregnant person wearing men's suits.
A cross-dressing?
Cross-dressing pregnant woman, yeah.
You also have, as one of the characters in the story, a woman, Natalie Dunois, and she's writing a biography of this woman, Lou Villars. But she's really, she's an extremely unreliable biographer. I mean, she makes things up.
Well, you know, the only, when I was trying to find out as much as I could about Violette Morris to translate her into Lou Villars, there wasn't that much out there. So the one thing I had was this French biography that was written in the 70s. I just couldn't tell. It seemed like totally bogus to me. You know, no footnotes, no bibliography, full of what she thought, what she said. How did this guy know? So when I was trying to write the parts, because there are all these different narrators, but sooner or later I had to write the parts about Lou. And she was the most difficult for the obvious reasons and the most interesting. I mean, how does someone who starts out as a relatively normal person wind up doing the things she did? So I tried it first person, second person, letters, all these different ways. And finally, I hit on the idea of writing my own fake biography. And it was so great because all my problems with the characters, I could just put off onto the biographer. I mean, my problems became her, you know, I didn't understand the character, she didn't understand the character, so I didn't have to worry about it anymore.
And I was also wondering, about a minute before our break here, whether you were saying to us as the reader, you know, biographers are unreliable. I mean, especially if you've never met this person and spent time with them, how good a portrait can you create of this person?
Well, yeah. I mean, everyone has their own version. And in fact, one of the things that made the novel kind of hard to write was that each character has his or her conflicting versions of what happened. And I had to kind of keep straight what actually happened because the characters, the more I wrote, the more persuasive they seemed to me. And I was just believing them. And then I would think, wait, this isn't actually the truth.
And that's actually our guest, Francine Prose, and we're talking about her new book. It's a novel called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She's the author of some 20 novels, essays, and works of nonfiction as well. Currently distinguished visiting writer at Bard, former president of the Pan American Center. We're going to talk more about this book, about this time and place, and also another reading as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, AS1812's annual political comedy, This is the Week That Is. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and This is the Week That Is Ensemble, this annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on the day's most important news, from Russian invasions to dog curbing in South Philadelphia. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley College. This summer, DelVal is offering a wide selection of accelerated full-term and online degree completion programs. Courses include business administration, biology, chemistry, education, and computer and business information systems. College students can take advantage of these classes and get ahead of their course load in time for the fall semester. Scholarship information and full course catalog at delval.edu/summer. Delaware Valley College. Convenient. Accessible. Flexible.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Francine Prose about her new novel. It's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 32, set in the years leading up to World War II, based on the true story of a cross-dressing, race car-driving Nazi collaborator named Violet Morris. Hard to say that, actually. Made famous by the photographer Brassai. And Francine Prose doing some readings for us and also talking about how a photograph that she saw became the inspiration for this novel. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Again, telling the story from a number of different perspectives, including a journalist you call Lionel Main. Talk a bit about Lionel Main, and then I'd love to have you read a section from the book.
Well, he's based a little on Henry Miller. And Henry Miller was a very close friend of Brassai's, so I knew that I wanted him to be in the novel. And Brassai wrote a book about Henry Miller, and Brassai appears as a character under a different name in Henry Miller's novels. And, you know, when I think of Paris at that time, Henry Miller is one of the main people, I think. You know, food, sex, wine, women, song, expatriate, move to Paris, you know, and all that energy and life. And of all the narrators in the book, I have to say he was the easiest to write. I don't know why. I mean, it was kind of scary to me that it was so easy to get in touch with my inner Henry Miller. But it really was, partly because he was, you know, a nonstop talker and a big life lover and full of himself and a big egomaniac. You know, by now we've all met enough people like that, so it wasn't.
So it's kind of fun to write about him again.
It was huge fun to write.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section where we meet him.
So Lionel is writing a memoir called Make Yourself New. Make Yourself New by Lionel Main. Reflections on Self-Pity, Paris, October 1928. Among the demons that taunt a writer before he can open a vein and write in his own blood are the devils that whisper, "Are you brave enough to tell the truth? Crazy enough to reveal the magic secret that will lose its power if even one other person finds out. Let's say you've discovered a cure for the garden variety psychic ills that plague mankind. Guilt, anxiety, envy, dread, and above all, self-pity. And let's say the cure is Paris. Let's say you put this discovery in a book that by some miracle is read by millions worldwide. And some fraction of its readers decide to do what you did, sell everything, cut every tie, move to Paris with nothing but a good pair of walking shoes and the will to survive on cigarette smoke, wine, sex, music, poetry, and moonlight on the Seine. Pretty soon, you can't turn a corner without running into a crowd of Americans who have followed you here under the illusion that the City of Light is an asylum for Cincinnati neurotics. But I'm determined to write a new kind of book. And so, despite the likelihood that I'm sealing my own doom, I will shout it in uppercase letters, Make Yourself New in Paris. Self-pity makes it easy to write, thanks to the diabolical voice hissing in my ear. You can say whatever you want. No one will ever read it. You can write, Come to Paris and look me up, and I'll lend you 50 francs without fear of one person taking you up on your offer.
That's a great, great introduction to this character, Lionel Main. And what I also like is you give him a girlfriend who's even more voracious for sex and apparently food
right.
than even he is. He can hardly keep up with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, I mean, not much of a spoiler. She deserts him because she finds something even more interesting. But again, you know, for me, writing the novel, there was a series of dots that I had to connect. So I knew, for example, that Brassai had taken this photo of a woman lying in the street, maybe dead, picked up by an ambulance. And I thought that he staged. So I thought, okay, who are you going to get to lie in the street for you? You know, not your friend, not your relative. It's got to be your girlfriend. So I had to kind of move her over from Lionel to Gabor to make her be the willing model for this photo.
He says, or you write, are you brave enough to tell the truth? I mean, is that something that as a writer yourself you struggle with?
Well, you know, sitting down to write a story that has as its center a cross-dressing Nazi lesbian auto racer torturer was pretty daunting. I mean, it really was not a cakewalk. So it took a lot of effort and work and time and, mm-hmm. and also courage. But you know, my son, the musician son, told me that there's this great saying that maybe Art Pepper said, which is, if you're going out to play a solo and you're not nervous about the thing you're going to play, chances are the thing you're going to play is probably not very good.
Oh, wow.
Which I loved. You know, and wow. I thought, well, that's true. If it doesn't scare you, why write it?
But it also seems that you, and even through some of the characters, especially the biographer in your book, is interested in trying to understand what evil is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the sort of impossible question, which is how does someone, in the case of your character, even Violette Morris, growing up in Paris, become not just a Nazi sympathizer, but a collaborator and a torturer? I mean, that's one of the most sort of profound, almost unanswerable questions.
It's endlessly interesting. And guess what? It's unanswerable. But I tried, you know, and I tried. I mean, one of the classes I taught up at Bard was a class on evil, on the literature of evil. It was when I was working on the book, so I felt that my poor students were my kind of, you know, guinea pig researchers. Mm-hmm. So we just started with the Book of Genesis and read on through Beowulf and Macbeth and so forth, just trying to look at that same issue and how, because, you know, anyone who's lived in this century has, I think, thought about that problem. Mm-hmm. You know, how does someone who starts off as a relatively normal, more or less decent human being become a participant in, let's say, a genocide?
And as we meet your character, as she's a young girl, she does hit her head. I mean, there's mm-hmm. and she's not a particularly well-loved child. Can I say that?
You can say that.
And so, which raises questions. You know, is it brain damage? Is that this is a neglected and scorned or spurned child that mm-hmm. then sort of turns on humanity?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was reading a lot. I mean, I read a lot you could call it research or just reading. I was reading a lot about the origins of fascism and totalitarianism because I was, you know, always curious about it. And it seemed to me that one of the things I kept reading and finding was when people feel, you know, the German people were told that they were stabbed in the back by the Treaty of Versailles. And when people are filled with resentment and told that someone else is at fault for everything that's gone wrong for them, they're vulnerable to that kind of politics. I mean, all you need is enough resentment, enough poverty, enough shortages, and a demagogue, and you have a volatile situation. Mm-hmm. So certainly that was the case with Lou. Nothing went right for her. All she wanted, really, was to be an auto racer, an athlete, and be loved, and none of those things worked out. And then when she went to Germany and Hitler made her feel like a valued, special person, she was easy prey for him.
In fact, there's a scene where she's at a Nazi rally, and she sees everyone, you know, Sieg Heil ding, mm-hmm. and sort of on cue responding to Hitler's speeches, and it made her feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, she felt like either accepted or she sort of knew what was expected of her.
Well, she was part of that crowd, and she was accepted, and she was caught up with that enthusiasm. I mean, one of the things I did for research, I watched Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will and the Olympiad movie. You know, the Olympiad is just, it couldn't be more boring. But I wanted to know what the athletes wore when they passed the reviewing stand. But Triumph of the Will, it's such a strange movie because you know how evil it all is, and you know, but there's something about the beauty of it and the romance that it's not as if you can understand why people did that, but you just get a sense of how heady it was and what it was like to be part of that crowd.
I mean, and I guess the spectacle sort of adds to people's mm-hmm. either sense of insecurity or giving them these symbols to mm-hmm. hold on to. Mm-hmm. I was recently at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and I've been there several times. And even when I get to the bottom, and you see all of that, I still don't understand.
I know.
I still don't understand.
Well, you know, and what is it that's Don DeLillo's great novel, White Noise? The protagonist is teaching Hitler studies class. And one of my sons said, it's always Hitler studies at our house, Mom, for that same reason.
Really?
Just how did that happen? How did something like that happen?
Well, in fact, you wrote a book about Anne Frank.
Mm-hmm.
You also had I think the first time I interviewed you, you wrote a novel, A Changed Man,
mm-hmm.
I mean, based on
mm-hmm.
a neo-Nazi who mm-hmm. joined with a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is, I mean, besides cross-dressing, this also has something that is
another obsession.
You.
Yeah.
Is it important to be obsessed as a writer?
I think we're all working out of our obsessions all the time. And they're sort of a strange list. You know, when you actually look at the things that, I mean, obviously I'm obsessed with the Holocaust, with evil. I seem to be obsessed with weddings, with dinner parties. There are always, you know, wedding scenes that show, with driving. I don't drive.
Oh, you don't drive
I don't
at
drive.
All?
No. I mean, I did. I was like, I learned too late. I was the world's worst driver. There was kind of a family intervention. You know, this mom.
They took your keys away?
Yeah, basically. So, but my characters either are people who can't drive and are pretending to drive, or in this case, an auto racer. So I had to learn a great deal about antique cars, vintage mm-hmm. cars, auto racing in the 30s in France and throughout Europe, the various races, which were, you know, a big bloody mess at the beginning. But it was all fascinating to me.
Well, and in this character, I think in the true story as well, Violette or Lou has to sort of tape her breasts so that she can fit into the car because I guess they were designed for men and not women.
Yeah, and then the true thing that happened, which I was, again, no picnic to put in the novel, was that Violette Morris underwent a voluntary double mastectomy so that she could fit behind the wheel mm-hmm. of the racing car. And there was a trial very much, there was a trial in which she tried to get her license back. And that fact was brought up at the trial as mm-hmm. evidence of her unnatural behavior and so forth. And it happened.
Yeah. Can you understand that kind of obsession, I guess?
Well, you know, I sit at my desk for 12 hours a day by myself. I can understand obsession.
And that's Francine Prose, our guest today in Radio Times here on WHYY. I guess I was also thinking about, you know, what the sort of extremes this character goes to do what she cares most deeply mm-hmm. about, obviously race car driving and being so sort of athletic and perhaps even being a man.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you're interested in cross-dressing and all mm-hmm. of that. Is it the sort of the idea of being somebody else or transforming yourself into somebody else?
Well, you know, actually, I hadn't thought about it exactly, but that's what I do. I mean, you know, when I was writing this novel, which has six or seven different major narrators, I would go to my study and become those people and be channeling those people. Mm-hmm. And that was the great pleasure of it. I mean, you get tired of being yourself after a while, or I do. And the joy of going to my desk and being Henry Miller or being a French resistance heroine or being and having to get inside their skins and think the way they thought and talk the way and hear their language and their voices was a thrill, really.
And do you find that this book was this a hard book to write?
I was at the risk of an unpleasant pun, it was torture, really. It took 5 years. And for 3 of those 5 years, I thought, this is too hard. I just can't do it. And then something kind of broke mm-hmm. through. And for the last 2 years, I thought, this is really hard, but I can do it.
And again, Francine Prose, our guest today on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I was reading that one of the books that I guess helped you write this novel called Into That Darkness, An Examination of Conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the book and how that helped you.
Oh, it's an extraordinary book. It's by a what is this strange, speaking of obsessions, fascination with Hungarians, by a Hungarian journalist named Gita Serenyi, who I think died recently. And it's a book-length interview with the commandant of the Treblinka extermination camp. And she just asks him how he got to do what he did. And, you know, he started out as a small-time cop in Austria, and he didn't get along with his superior, and he was worried about his job. And then he was offered a job in the euthanasia program, and he turned out to be quite good at it. And then he went from there to Treblinka. And there's this extraordinary scene, because Gita Serenyi She also wrote a book about Albert Speer, Hitler's architect, which is another amazing book. So she interviews all the people connected with, you know, the secretaries, the wives. She interviews Stengel, his name is Stengel's wife, and she says, if you had stopped him, if you had told him not to do this job, would he have done it? And Frau Stengel says, I couldn't have done anything. There's nothing I could have done. And then she goes home and writes a letter in the middle of the night and says, actually, I could have. And then she speaks to Gide Serenyi and says, could you put in the first version or the second, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. And Gide Serenyi says, I realize this is a letter written in the middle of the night. Would you mind if I put in both versions of your story? And the woman says, okay. So, you know, that question, you know, how did someone do this and how did the people close to the person react to it was hugely helpful. I mean, I mentioned A Course on Evil. We read that book for the class and to talk about it.
I'm asking you to, you know, put yourself back in history. I mean, if you could have interviewed Violette Morris, what would you have asked her? What would you have wanted to know?
Well, you know, my fake biographer, Natalie, that's what she says the first thing. If only I could have had half an hour to talk to her woman to woman and said, why did you do this? Why? Because, you know, I come close to the answer to the question and all, and I'm circling around the question, but do I finally know? I don't think there's an answer. You know, I mean, I couldn't be happier with the reviews I've gotten. I mean, I've been so fortunate, and they've been so intelligent. But the only ones that kind of seemed to me not to get it were the ones that said, well, we never really get to know the main, you know, woman, Lou Villar. Well, yeah, because you can't. I mean, you know, unless you're that person, there's no getting to know that person. There's no finally understanding why someone would do that.
And it is the kind of Rashomon effect. Mm-hmm. So you've got all these people that sort of know pieces of Lou Villar that tell us a bit about her, but nonetheless, you know, can't really have that definitive explanation about why she did what she did.
Right. And, you know, I mean, everyone has their version of what happened. And the fact is, I mean, there's a sort of a big love triangle that runs through the novel. The photographer, his girlfriend, Suzanne, and the Baroness, art collector, art patron, married to the race car manufacturer. And, you know, any time you have a love triangle, you have three different versions of what's happening. So right there was something that I knew was going to be Rashomon-like because they each had a different idea about what the others were feeling.
So you're saying that, you know, looking for that answer to that question about why would someone do such heinous things, we really can't know, even though so much has been written about the Holocaust and about all the sort of players in the Holocaust, we'll never really know.
We can't know about ourselves, I think. I mean, one of the things I was interested in was, you know, we all think we know what we would do in a certain situation. So here it happens, you know, the Nazis invade France. And I had to figure out at a certain point, and really I had to take a certain amount of time away from writing to figure out what each one of my characters would do. And in some cases it was surprising even to me. Who would stay? Who would do something? Who would join the resistance? Who would leave France? Who did what? And many of them were not quite predictable given what we knew about the characters, but I think that's also the case. People behave in surprising ways.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Now, Francine Prose is our guest today on the show. She's written more than 20 books, I think, something like that. She just rolled her eyes at me. And her new one is called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She's currently distinguished visiting writer at Bard and former president of the Pan American Center. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines, 1-888-477-94. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden encourages working professionals to expect more from graduate programs. The MBA is a 21-month accelerated program with classes held on Saturdays, one starting this June in Mount Laurel and the other this August in West Windsor. An information session will be held at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 20th at the Mercer County College Conference Center or the Enterprise Center at Burlington County College, Thursday, May 22nd at 6:30 p.m. pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
Are you tired of boring dinner parties? Wish you could impress your in-laws? Tune in to Fresh Air for coverage of politics, novels, filmmaking, and world affairs that you'll be talking about for days. Astonish your friends. Amaze your colleagues. Fresh Air, giving you something to talk about for over 20 years.
Tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you're just joining us, Francine Prose is our guest. She's been a guest a couple of times on Radio Times to talk about some of her books, and again, her new one called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. We've been talking about how this book got created, how difficult it was, based in part on the life of a real woman who was a cross-dressing, race car driving Nazi collaborator, if you can imagine, and she was assassinated during World War II, or killed during World War II. And Francine Prose reading from some of the book and talking about some of the issues in the book as well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Adolf Hitler is in this book as well. Did you have any hesitation about including him in this story?
Of course.
What a difficult character.
Let's write a dinner party with Hitler. But I mean, it was weirdly liberating to do it. And it was, you know, somehow there it was. It was like writing about the devil or something. Suddenly there it was, and I could do it. And it's a dinner. I mean, Lou goes to Berlin, and she's fallen in love with a German woman race car driver, and together they go to this huge dinner in Hitler's honor the night before the Olympics begin. And the thing that made it possible, there's this book called Hitler's Table Talk that Martin Bormann wrote down everything Hitler said for over years. I mean, you can't read it straight through. You can leave it around and read. I mean, because it's so banal. But he went on at enormous length about his dietary habits and his nutritional ideas and so forth. So I just kind of lifted and changed big chunks of the Table Talk and put it into the novel.
And they have for their meal nut cutlets.
That's what he ate. He'd eat, like, you know, and he was also worried about his weight at that point. So he'd eat, nut, you know, a little bit of nut cutlet and pasta without sauce.
Mm. And that's truly what Hitler ate?
That's truly what Hitler ate.
And he's not a meat eater, right?
He was a vegetarian.
Which I was, to me, I just, you think of sort of stereotypically that a vegetarian sort of cares about humanity. I mean, if you kind of care about cows and pigs, you would think you would care about humanity.
Like you'd imagine Gandhi, right?
How can you be, you know, Hitler and be a vegetarian?
Haven't you known any vegetarians that you didn't think?
No, I get that. I'm just saying it's a struggle.
It's a struggle. I know. But he certainly was. But also he was an extremist in every way. So he just took it into areas of nutrition as well.
So how do you end a book like this? As you said, this took you about 5 years. It was a struggle. It's told from all these different perspectives. And I'm assuming, you know, beginnings are always important. And I'm assuming endings probably different, especially when there are all these various people and strands of the story.
Well, I knew that I wanted to bring it into the near present somehow, that I wanted there to be a gap of years. I knew that. I knew I wanted there to be, what do I want to say, a major surprise and reversal near the end. I knew that. And about halfway through, a little less than halfway, I had a sense of what that surprise would be. But then, you know, I mean, I always tell students this. If you can't think of how to end something or what to do next, just wait and life will give you something you can use. So this isn't a major spoiler because it's just something that happens in the novel. But I was in my garden, upstate New York, and I saw this thing that it looked like some mythical beast, like a dragon of some sort. And I looked at it and looked at it. And finally, I realized that it was a snake, a garden snake, that had begun to eat a frog, a very large frog, and couldn't, and unhinged its jaws, you know, the whole thing, but couldn't swallow the frog, and the snake couldn't move. So I stood there for like 10 minutes watching it, looking at it. It was just a standoff. The snake wasn't going anywhere. It was way too late to save the frog. That was not going to happen. I called my husband. He came down from his studio. He got his camera. We now have a picture of this in our, and I knew that this was going to be the last picture that we see our photographer character taken. But again, it happened. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen, and then it happened. So, you know, other things happen at the end. But this was the thing that I got from experience that I could put in the novel that let me get near the end.
And what an image, right?
I know.
Scary.
I know. Scary.
And how did it end for the snake? And the frog?
I have no idea. It went on. We were there for 20 minutes. We left. It was just, we went, let nature take its course. I couldn't bring myself to go back to the garden until the next day. I didn't want to know. And the snake was gone. The frog was gone. I have no idea what happened.
Wow. How do you work? And I'm curious about, I'm always interested in how writers write and how they do what they do. And everyone has their unique approach to writing. What's yours?
I go to my desk every minute I can.
Do you?
You know, people say, how do you get the discipline to go to your desk? Well, it's more like praying to get the time to go to my desk. And if nothing happens, I just sit there and wait.
Do you fiddle around and, you know, rearrange your books collection or something? Or you just
for this book, I did a lot of research, if you could call it that, on the internet and on YouTube. You know, so as everybody knows, whole days can sink down the hole of YouTube. So I spent a lot of time sort of going from clip to clip. So I did do that. And then I did a lot of reading. But basically, it sounds kind of nutty, but I just sat there until I heard the voices of these characters and then just started writing them down. It was taking a very weird sort of dictation.
And do you take, when you're preparing to write, are you taking notes? Mm-hmm. Are you scribbling things down?
I'm writing things down. Yeah. But I'm keeping them in a computer file because I can no longer read my own handwriting. So
no one can anymore.
I know. We all be doctors, right?
And, I mean, do you feel a novel working on you now? I mean, is there a story working on you now?
Yeah. I've begun to write little bits of a novel. I agreed to write a book for a series that's a very short biography of Peggy Guggenheim. Oh. Partly the reason I wanted to do it was because it was a way of not having to leave the world of the novel. So the Baroness in the novel is ever so slightly based on Peggy Guggenheim. I mean, like what the two of them have in common is just before the war broke out, they raced around Paris buying up art as quickly as they could because from desperate artists, basically. So that, you know, they do have that in common. So I'm almost finishing a draft of this Peggy Guggenheim book.
And you didn't turn it into a novel? I mean, make her a fictional character?
No.
Was it tempting at all to do that?
No, it was for a series of biographies, right. So there wasn't a chance.
You've also written novels for young people. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much do you have to reorient yourself to write for a quote-unquote younger crowd?
It's just pure fun. Writing the YA novels is fun because I'm less obsessive about sentences. I mean, you know, one of the reasons this novel probably went through 200 drafts, let's say, and I'm not kidding. I mean, I numbered them, and then so I have 15 that are numbered.
Wow.
And then I have no idea how many drafts within the drafts were written. But, you know, let's say 200. With YA novels, I'm so interested in the momentum of the story and keeping kids interested that I'm a little less obsessive about the sentences. Oh. And you can do things in a YA novel that you wouldn't do in, you know, I mean, you can end a chapter by saying something like, you know, but that was nothing compared to what happened next, which I'm not going to do in a book for grown-ups.
So are you a less critical editor when you're writing for YA?
Yeah, although I'm editing in a different way. I'm editing for momentum, let's say, rather than the perfection of the sentence.
And do you have a critical voice when you're writing, your own critical voice in your head?
Oh, it's terrible. It's hard. Well, you know, in a way, that's what you want. You want to be more self-critical than anyone could ever be. And that's what I tell students, too. You have to be your own harshest critic. And in fact, you know, my friends who are writers, it always amazes me that the ones I admire most, the ones whose work I'm in awe of, are the most racked by self-doubt.
Really?
And I can't, you know, often I think they have to be kidding me.
Like because, who? Who are we talking about?
Well, Deborah Eisenberg, you know, who's a genius, Charles Simic, both of them, you know, both tell me stories about, you know, moments when they just think, oh, it's all terrible, etc. And I just can't believe it.
I can't
it.
Do this anymore.
I can't do this, yeah.
Even after all their works. And you've written a lot as well.
Yeah.
Do you have those same...
Every day, Marty.
Really?
Really. Really. So, you know, in the way that's encouraging, I mean, I hope it's encouraging for people who are trying to write, that I think that it just is part of the, it just is part of the process. You know, you just think, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can do it.
But there has to be another voice that's saying, yes, I can.
Yeah,
can do
yeah,
this.
Yeah, 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 yeah. 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 Well, what's the Beckett thing? I can't go on, I can't go on, I can't go on, I'll go on.
All right. And again, that's Francine Prose, our guest today on Radio Times. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She's the author of some 20 novels, works of nonfiction as well. She's also written a number of essays. And she's currently a distinguished visiting writer at Bard College and former president of the Penn American Center. And I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Speaking of food, I was reading a piece about you and your husband, actually, who's an artist, in the Wall Street Journal about food. And food seems to be a really important feature of your marriage, of your family life.
Yeah, we've been married for 40 years, so I guess it works.
And he's a good cook,
and he's
right?
a very good cook. And he's kind of like Mozart. I mean, that is, you know, in the way Mozart could go hear a symphony and then write it down later. We can go to a restaurant and he can say, oh, I figured out how they did that.
Wow.
And, you know, plus we have a zillion cookbooks. That he doesn't follow recipes, but he says he reads them for attitude. So
I don't know how to do that.
I don't either. Well, I don't cook anymore. You know, I used to cook, but that was 40 years ago. You know, I mean, there's a family story. One of my sons had a friend over, and the friend said, can we have some scrambled eggs? And my son said, oh, yeah, my mom can do that. And the friend said, can we have some onions with the scrambled eggs? And my son said, I think we better wait for Dad to get home.
That would be much too complicated for you to do that. There's a scene, in the article about you where it sounds like you've been working all day and then you come downstairs at 5 o'clock and there's the smell of, you know, something in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that true?
That's it's what my favorite moment of the day, of ever. It's really great. And the article, actually, they asked for a recipe.
I saved that recipe, by the way.
It's a great recipe. It's a shrimp and clam risotto. I mean, a scallop and clam risotto. And not particularly difficult.
He also, in it, says when he met you for the first time, it sounded like he wanted to fatten you up. He thought you were a little too skinny.
Yeah, I was.
He didn't do a very good job, I have to say.
Thank you. I was astonished because the journalist said something like, still skinny. And I thought, really? Because I'm looking at the photograph and it doesn't seem that way to me. So.
And what is it like to have your life sort of put out there in the public?
Well, it was an odd experience. I mean, I liked it. I liked the article when I read it because it was a young journalist, very talented, it seemed to me, and he made us sound like us, which is a hard thing to do. I mean, the way we joke around, that's the way we joke around in the article.
Right. You teach at Bard, teach writing, and are there students that sort of almost at first sight you say you read, there's something that they have that's special and unique?
Well, you know, I teach literature. I don't teach writing, so I don't really read their work. But yes, I mean, every semester there's a moment or several moments where I say to my students, who are you? You know, how do you know this? Because everything that students are not supposed to be, well-read, hardworking, motivated, complicated, politically aware, they are. So it just feels like a great gift. I mean, and also it feels, because it's a literature class, I feel like I have my own little book club where I don't have to be democratic about whose turn it is to decide what we read. I decide what we read, and they read it. But I'm always interested in what they have to say and their take on books, because I learn something every time I teach a story, even if it's a story I thought I knew by heart.
Wow.
One of them will say something that I haven't thought about before.
I was reading that Gabriel Marquez, one of your favorite authors, and obviously recently died.
I dropped out of graduate school because of 100 Years of Solitude.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I read it when I was a graduate student at Harvard in English literature, and I was going to these seminars, and at some point in the middle of it, I read 100 Years of Solitude, and I thought, these classes I'm going to, they're not fun.
Oh.
This novel is fun. Maybe it would be fun to try and write a novel. So that's really, you know, it really had a huge influence on me.
That thought never crossed your mind until you read that book?
Not, you know, I didn't, honestly, I kind of didn't know that books were written by people. I mean, somehow it just didn't, you know, there, when I was at that age, there weren't a lot of MFA programs. There wasn't, you know, there wasn't sort of writing as an industry or profession the way there is now. I mean, I just, these books were on the shelves, and I knew in theory that there had been a real Charles Dickens or sure. George Eliot, but I didn't know any writers, and I didn't know that it was something you could do. That it was something you could do with your life.
Were you a reader growing up?
I was
up?
A huge reader. The family story. We're driving across the country, and my father says, "Don't you even want to look at the Grand Canyon?" And
I'm like, get out of the car.
Yeah, I'm in the back of the car reading a book.
And what were some of those childhood books that you liked?
I loved Pippi Longstocking. I loved. A little later, I loved Isaac Dinesen. But, you know, no one ever told me that there was a difference between serious literature and books. I just, so, you know, James Michener and Leon Uris and Gone with the Wind, I just devoured everything that I could find. You know, the public library, what a great institution. Mm. I would just go there. And I don't know what it's like now, but then in the summers, kids could take out as many books as they could carry home. So I would walk to the library and stagger home under the weight of all these books, wow, and just read through them and then go back and do it again.
So maybe your friends were playing outside, but you were Francine mm-hmm. Prose inside reading a book?
Yes, the pale little...
right.
The pale little reader.
And you were telling me that you... had to change your Wikipedia page, right? Is that?
I was full of mistakes. It was just full of
mistakes.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah, and I had to write I wrote a piece for the back of the Times Book Review about internet research, and that seemed to me the best and only way I could figure out to change the mistakes. I mean, I said, look, anyone who says this about me, I know where you found it out. It's on the Wikipedia page. Not true. And sure enough, about 2 weeks later, the mistakes disappeared mysteriously.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Francine Prose, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And the book called Lovers at the Chameleon Club Paris 1932 has just been published. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. Helping us out today, Emily Hawes and Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.